writer, publisher, magico-anthropologist, filmmaker, and photographer. Since the mid-1980s, he's been active in the magical community, integrating a culture as a way of life and lecturing about his findings and speculations. He's the editor and publisher of the annual classy occultural zine, The Fenris Wolf, the author of a collected series of essays called Resonances with friends of the podcast Scarlet Imprint, and many other books, and has produced works of art in almost every known medium, some of which we are doubtless going to explore today. Carl, welcome to Esoteric Island Discs.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on this desert island.
So you've had a very interesting life. It's going to unfold musically as we proceed. But if we start at the beginning, Ornette Coleman plays a role in your very early life. I wonder if we can use that as a starting point to get things rolling.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a funny story, and I think one that at least unconsciously shaped me very much. The thing was that in the mid-60s, there was a great surge of specifically American jazz musicians touring, kind of a perpetual tour, basically in order to avoid the draft for the Vietnam War, you know, because if you were a professional musician, you could be on the road and then you didn't have to get drafted. So in each civilized European capital or bigger city, there was a jazz club that catered to this very vital scene of great jazz. And my father was running the one in Stockholm. It was called the Golden Circle. And at the time when I was just about to be born in January of 1966, Ornette Coleman was in town, basically, and he buzzed my parents' apartment. He had bought a cradle for me, and it was so sweet. And I still, I kept it. My parents kept it after I'd been rocking in it. And also my daughter, much later, also rocked in it. Wow. But that was kind of an interesting thing because it made me reevaluate the experience, because when I grew up as a kid and as a teenager, I of course hated jazz because it was my, you know, my father's great love, basically. And much later, when I'd come across that into a more serious individuation myself, I realized that maybe not all kinds of jazz is my cup of tea. However, to get my cradle from Ornette Coleman was like, you know, a mind-blowing experience. And interestingly enough, it haunted me, if we can jump forward in time a little bit also, because of the fact that at about the same time, we're talking 1965, 1966, Ornette Coleman was basically the musical producer for a film that came later on to play a very big part of my life, basically, for reasons of inspiration and aesthetics. And that's Chappaqua by Conrad Rooks from 1966. Won the Silver Lion in Venice, whatever it's called, Silver something, and with William Burroughs playing the head of the rehabilitation clinic. It's very funny. Anyway, I came to love that movie much later on, but it was actually Ornette Coleman who was the musical producer of that. And also in terms of the connection with Burroughs, Burroughs and Ornette Coleman went to Jajuka together to record separately. Jujuka, that village outside of Tangiers in Morocco, which is part of this mythos of the Beatniks, of Brian Gysin and William Burroughs, yeah. Also Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, of course, who all went there to record. And much later, in 2019, just pre-pandemic, I went there with my wife, and we actually got to see the master musicians of Jujuka play in the village and hang out with them and stuff. So that was yet another kind of full circle moment, in a way. That's all tied in with us, with this early rocking in my cradle.
Cool. And you went on rocking, and we'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah. You know, yeah, you could say that. Not so much in the, you know, crazy jazz kind of sense, but I certainly drifted into, I would say I was a little bit too young for punk proper, but certainly post-punk and indie and you know, good, great, timeless rock and roll I've always loved, and has become part also, or was a part early on, part of my magical arsenal, in the sense that people talk about, you know, magical weapons or magical tools, and it's always like, you know, some kind of classical things with wands and discs and cups and, you know, these kinds of things. And I've certainly worked with those things too, but they are for me quite fickle symbols. you know, it, of course, it depends on what you invest in them. But for me, early on, as a magical tool in the process of individuation and also in terms of concrete magical workings, was always music. Mm. And the capacity of music to evoke suitable ambiances for daydreaming. I believe daydreaming is one of my most potent potent magical tools. And I often take a nap, I would say, at least once a day. That's not saying I'm doing magic always during those things, but it's so, you know, invigorating and rejuvenating and in every way. And you could also say that I was formatted as a magician, of course, as most people, like in the teens. But in the teens, you're kind of confused and you look for things and you're like a sponge in a way or a funnel. We're just trying to amass stuff. And then gradually it filters into something more crystallized, I guess. For me, though, the music of this formative time, basically, again, early to mid-80s, and then, of course, onwards, was so important. Because at that time, when you're a teenager or slightly older, an old teenager, kind of mopey, you're introspective, and you need music to sort of get you cathartically along the way. And there was simply so much great music at that time. And I'm thinking specifically of British music, you know, Factory Records and all that stuff became such an important part of my life. I wouldn't say that they are still active ingredients in my magical toolbox, but they certainly were at the time. And that's one of the reasons why I have two of the tracks that I've chosen for this session comes from that era and carries that, for me, cathartic force through the process of daydreaming, simply listening to music and traveling almost like, you know, pseudo shamanically on that emotional roller coaster. And it sets you free. You can process stuff. So there's an element of psychoanalysis in there also. And later on, I realized that while in these states, meditative states, with certain kinds of emotional mood setters through specific musics, I could also use that for magical workings. You know, call it astral or interior or whatever. You know, using that incredible emotional force as a wrapper, as a mitten, as a warm jacket in which I could perform some kind of interior magic.
Well, let's hear your first track. What is you chosen?
Yeah, the first track is really a dear favorite, and it still packs a punch today. It's from New Order's first album. It's called Dreams Never End, which I think is a very fitting title also, because I do think that's true. Here we're in 1981, and Joy Division, no more. New Order takes the place after Ian Curtis' suicide. And funnily enough, this is the first track of the first album of New Order. And it's not sung by Bernard Sumner. It's actually sung by Peter Hook, the bass player. And I don't want to analyze too much. I just love this song very, very much.
Okay. New Order, Dreams Never End. Carl, how did you get into a culture? I feel like with everyone who gets into magic, who explores this path, there's usually some kind of superhero origin story, you know? What's your origin story in a nutshell? What were the gateway drugs?
I think as far as I've analyzed it, and I have done so a great deal, including writing, you know, this autobiography that came out last year, for instance, made me go through all the old diaries. I started writing a diary in the mid-80s and, you know, diligently since then. So there was a lot of fodder there. It was quite revealing and sometimes a little bit too banal. But I think what happened was that I grew up in a very cultured home. There was a lot of art. There was a lot of books. And I told you my father was a jazz freak. So there was not only jazz music, but, you know, artists and jazz musicians. And yeah, I wouldn't say bohemian, but it was quite a lively upbringing. And I think the pure immersion in books and art and music and also movies rubbed off, you know, as happens. But I just felt that, okay, this is very cool. This is how life is supposed to be lived, according to my parents, but I need my own stuff, right? So I had that immersion, exposure in a way, but I needed to find my own distinct resonances. So when you're young, you know, I loved comic books, and that was already a mix of, like, you know, French kind of high cultured comics and American underground comics, even at a young age,
right?
Because there were some good bookstores where you could buy that. And again, there was an influx of kind of radical American people coming through into the sphere of my parents. So I was familiar with the Fabulous Freak Brothers and No Robert Crumb. And I was exposed to that and loved it. And of course, you know, in a way, you know, Marvel and those kinds of more commercial comics. And that led to movies and it led to music. And it all became kind of a multifaceted snowball that is still rolling in a way, where I've always been very... I would say voraciously hungry for input in terms of, same thing, books and movies and music. And through that, of course, after a while, you know, you start to crystallize because you orient yourself intuitively after the resonances. And I think that there was in these stores, for instance, or in these different kinds of media, magic was a natural part of that, right? Whether it was thematically about magic or whether it was mentioned or whether it was an ad, there was something intriguing there. And I think also in this soul-searching process or meditative states that I experienced through music, there was a kind of an empowering sense that I think coalesced or merged into something, you know. And an important part of the story is that kind of a highbrow, low-life avenue was, for instance, how two things gelled or merged. I was fascinated by Anton LaVey early on because you could read about Anton LaVey in Swedish men's magazines, you know, look at the crazy magicians, they have naked ladies at the altar, stuff like that. Yeah. And I mean, who doesn't love that? I was totally fascinated. And then at the same time, in the slightly trashier sense, I loved, you know, Marilyn Monroe, you're great, but I loved Jane Mansfield. You know, slightly trashier version in a way. And then I found out, whoa, what's happening here? They knew each other, Jane Mansfield and LaVey. And that sort of triggered something that there's a big world out there and there are weird people and sometimes they meet and create very interesting little sparks that set off, you know, prurient fantasies in the minds of young men like me.
Yeah. You followed the Anton LaVey and Jane Mansfield track all the way to California. We'll get to that anon.
Yeah.
But before we do, what is your next track and why?
Yes, I would like to stay in this very, you know, melancholy mind frame that was going on in my mind in the early to mid 80s. When I was really waking up to all of this stuff. And that's going back 1 year and not to New Order's first album, but to the final album of Joy Division called Closer. And it's a song called Heart and Soul. The time between Heart and Soul and Dreams Never End, it's not really that long, you know, but at the same time, they both carry the kind of emotional state of mind that I was in. So let's return to 1980 and Joy Division, Heart and Soul.
And so, what will we do?
Heart and Soul by Joy Division. It's a very synthy start you've brought us on, sort of to this esoteric island, but it's going to start to rock out a bit more as we proceed. You got into what one might call the more magical side of things. I think also just voracious for the avant-garde, what's happening, what's hip, starting to sniff around and get involved. How did you first get involved with the sort of larger music scene and magical scene?
Yeah, it's a kind of a straight line there. I think my psychological composition, or the way I'm constructed, is that in my voracious hunger, I find things that I love, and I have an inherent need of sharing it with others. And what happened was that already back in the comic book days, this, now we're talking 1981, I created a fanzine interviewing comic book artists. And you know, then you have a fanzine, you sell it, then you go to comic cons, whatever, and try to sell it. And that very quickly shifted into music. And I had a fanzine together with friends called Lollipop, which was about the music of the time, garage rock, good stuff, trash movies. And that eventually led on towards the late 1980s into the Fenris Wolf. That was originally an occultural fanzine. So I've always been that kind of fanzine guy, wanting so enthusiastically to share whatever it was that I had found. So basically, through this fanzine making, I felt a sense of empowerment, because I knocked on, you know, backstage doors and stuff, and more often than not, bands let me in so I could take some pictures and ask questions. That sort of enabled me and empowered me to be that guy who became more of a go-getter. So, for instance, I really was inspired by the occultism, which was very contemporary, of the Temple of Psychic Youth, you know, the organization connected to Psychic TV in the early 80s and onwards. And I found it so amazing, because it was like contemporary, new, and they wove in other things, literary ideas and contemporary magical ideas. It wasn't just like a museum of magic, and I wanted to be involved in that. And basically, through Lollipop, which was still the music fanzine, I met Genesis Peorage for the first time in 1986, after having been like a Topi subscriber for a while. And that led on to a very, very long friendship and my engagement in the Temple of Psychic Youth, and then all kinds of snowballs emerging from that initial boost. So all of that came from me seeking out specific people that I was admiring or felt inspired by. And what happened was that, for reasons I cannot explain, maybe just my audacity, I don't know, I was welcomed in so many environments of great magical power and potential that I could never, you know, have imagined when I was listening to Joy Division a few years earlier. It was just so remarkable, and it really formatted me into the person I am today. You know, whereas, you know, parents and other people, oh no, what's he doing? You know, but I'm just a lifer. I'm just thriving on that kind of initial impetus, and I've been doing fairly well doing that. So no regrets on that side. And I guess maybe we should talk about the LaVey connection, because that again ties in with the rock and roll, and it's a funny story. As happens when you're young and you love rock and roll, you want to have your own band. And so I wanted to have my own band, and it was called White Stains, after the Crowley poetry collection.
Yep.
The first record we made was an ode, a homage, a love song to not only to Jane Mansfield, but also to the relationship that LaVey and Mansfield had. It was called Sweet Jane, just like the Lou Reed song. And Genesis at this time said that, this is great, you should send this to LaVey, when the record came out. And I thought, you know, literally, what the hell? And I did. And then I got this amazing letter back, not only, you know, lauding the initiative, but also making me a member and saying, you know, basically, we stayed in touch. And then about, I don't know, 1 year later, I went to the U.S. for the first time to hang out at the Black House. And on the same trip, meeting Kenneth Anger, who had been writing a thesis about Aleister Crowley's influence in Kenneth Anger's films. And it was just like a complete mind-blowing initiation with so many people that I had admired. And it wasn't unreachable. On the contrary, they opened their doors and sort of dragged me in. And it was really, you know, funny. And tried to work hard these past years paying back in order to pay forward in a way, also making documentaries about Kenneth Anger, about Jan, about LaVey, also writing books with Jan and about LaVey, and an Anger book is coming out late next year, etc., etc. So I'm still immersed, but I'm trying to leave it behind, not because I'm bored with it, just like it's time to move into something else.
I wonder what you think of this. Like back in the 80s, in the era of fanzines and tape trading, and our local record store cannot get these records from the US because they simply don't export them, but I can write a letter to a guy at some home address and he will send me tapes. That whole scene, and the Temple of Psychic Youth was in a way a kind of mail order occult order, but not in the cheesy Amorc way, like in a sort of avant-garde mail art way, very different from anything that had come before, I think. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, when everything is at your fingertips on the internet, do you feel like paradoxically that kind of vitality of a scene has been lost because it's, I don't know, I just feel like there were these very potent connections made by people like you in the 80s, just writing a letter to Anton LaVey and going, hey, Anton LaVey, we made this song about you. And he writes back saying, hey, that's really cool. Come visit me. And this sort of thing happened all the time, right? And nowadays, it's, I don't know, that kind of, even it's like we're in a way too connected. It's a bit like things are somehow just a little too easy. And that maybe we've lost something.
I think it's a matter of inflation, right? And inflation has to do not simply with quantity, but also with the lack of tangibility. Because when everything is digital or sort of abstracted in that sense, there's nothing to touch. There's nothing to be immersed in with your senses. Well, maybe you could listen to music on the computer. That's fine. But I remember so vividly all of these things that filled me with great joy, both in receiving and also sending out, was tangible products and things like record covers. Someone sent a collage, whatever. It was just filled with a more evocatory sense of communication, a deeper kind of communication that I don't perceive that there even exists now, because an email is only matter of fact. There is no calligraphy. There are no like stamps or there's no sense of uniqueness to it. It's mere stripped, raw, naked message communication, if you're lucky. Or if you're not lucky, you might get some, you know, strain of emojis. So I think that's one of the things that made that scene so strong. As you say, there was a distinct connection to the mail art movement in Topi, for instance. And Jen had been sending out, you know, he's a avid postal guy, you know, sending out so much mail and also receiving so much mail and networking in that way. In that sense, networking is totally possible today. But on the other hand, who really has the time to spend like 3 hours every night just checking out all the Substacks of all the people in the network?
Right.
You know, it's just something else. And I would call it inflation of ideas, inflation of real deep communication. And I don't feel nostalgic about it, but I'm very happy to have lived basically half my life without the internet. So at least I can become nostalgic later on in the story, perhaps,
right,
and think of the good old days when you could go to the P.O. box and get some stuff. That said, you know, each generation has to refine and define the very same process, though. There's nothing really new in that sense. And it's all about individuation. And that could be individual individuation or collective individuation. And that's why you have scenes. And I don't mean that as fanzines, but scenes of music and scenes of this and that. And when you're young, you create based on what's there an environment that's esoteric, because you need that esoteric sense to, again, refine and define yourself. And possibly with some network of friends or similar people. So I'm sure that's going on. I may be too old to fathom what's actually going on, but I do believe that those developments within the human psyche are kind of timeless. They're eternal, they're perpetual. So I'm not worried.
All right, well, let's turn to your next track. What is it and why?
Yeah, I think it could be good here to tie in a little bit with, we talked about Topi and of course Psychic TV. And Psychic TV was a strange band, went to many different phases. I cannot say that I like all of them, but I do remember as I got involved in Topi that the two first albums by Psychic TV, meaning Force the Hand of Chance and Dreams Less Sweet, were incredible, very powerful, because they carried on a tradition from Throbbing Gristle in a way, in that albums weren't put together in a normal way. They were really very dynamic, very flexible, very innovative. And I picked out a song called The Orchids from the second one called Dreams Less Sweet. And The Orchids, I think, brings out something that Jen had that people usually don't talk about. And that's the sensitive poet in a way, that people project so many things on Jen. But one of the things that attracted me to Jen originally was the quality of the voice and also the poetry. And then came the magic and you know, all the interesting, weird, transgressive ideas. So I think The Orchids by Psychic TV is a good song to sort of sum up my state of mind. Now we're in the mid 1980s.
When all the numbers swim together and all the shadows settle, when doors forced open shut again, a flytrap and a petal, my eyes burn and claws rush to fill them. And in the morning after the night, I fall in love with the light. It is so clear I realize that here at last I have my eyes. When all the figures sound retreat, the soft skin starts to shrivel. When dreams made real become less sweet, the orchid and the metal, my sex turns and claws rush to spill them. But in the morning after the night, I fall in love with the light. It is so pure I can arise without the fear of secret lies. Na 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 na. When all the characters form sign, every moon is level. When all the spirits burn in line, center pierced by steel, my eyes burn and claws rush to fill them. But in the morning after the night, I fall in love with the light. It is so clear I realize, and now at last I have my eyes. And in the morning after the night, I fall in love with the light. And in the morning after the night, I fall in love with the light. I fall in love with the light. And in the morning after the night, I fall in love with the light.
Orchids by Psychic TV. That is a really, really lovely track. It's got, yeah, just the instrumentation is really quite tasteful and beautiful, and the lyrics are very compelling as well. It's a really, really nice track. It's sometimes what you might call music that is a full artistic project. The music itself doesn't stand so well on its own, just as listening music, but that track definitely does.
I think that one of the keys to that is that the projects at this time, and also true for Throbbing Gristle, they were ideas driven. They were driven by ideas and concepts pure experimentation and also weaving in intellectual fodder. And that was also, you know, what attracted me to it, both to TG and Psychic TV and to Topi, was the fact that it was artistic, obviously artistic, innovative, but it also contained by design other ideas and other concepts, meaning it was kind of a ever-evolving and alive encyclopedia. And that, I think that was true for what was called the industrial culture. And I think that one of the most compelling and interesting and inspiring things was that it was totally an intellectual scene. It wasn't just like blurting out whatever negative emotions you had, as like in the punk days, but it was filled with often a kind of dark, esoteric information, and also freely shared in liner notes, in special lists, in books, of course, in interviews, lots of name dropping, book dropping, movie dropping. And it was incredibly formative. Most of the stuff was pretty good as well, you know, but I think this feeling of being part of something that was innovation, but also respecting the old. And I'm thinking perhaps specifically of honoring the surrealists in a way, or taking that kind of playful attitude, but clothing it in a critique of, for instance, 1980s Britain, which was kind of a dark, dire, straits place, and combining that into a mix completely unique to the time. That was something that attracted me to, yeah, to Jen's mind again, and to many other people as well. And something I've worked with myself, in the sense that freely sharing whatever I come across, that was already there from my fanzine days, but perhaps it grew even more because of my touching and going through the industrial scene.
That DIY ethos, which punk has sort of sometimes had and sometimes hasn't, you know what I mean?
But, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and also when that was there, that was no guarantee that the music was interesting.
Right.
I was thinking, for instance, of Crass, you know, the anarchic collective that was very interesting in terms of the ideas and stuff, but I could never get into the music. It was just too, pardon the pun, too crass, you know, not to my liking. I needed more versatile and maybe more artistic experimentation in a way. It's very rare that all of these things gel and merge, but sometimes they do. And I would say for me, Torben Grissel, and you know, early Psychic TV as well, just like we listened to the beautiful The Orchids track is the prime example. People were expecting more of Torben Grissel, this sort of violent or very dark, but then instead you have this sort of etheric thing with a poem basically describing genital piercings, but not in the sense that it's obvious.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that kind of subversion of expectation is a key to this.
Beautiful. And yeah, like it's okay to be a bit subtle, you know? You can be
Totally, absolutely. I think that's part of growing up in a way. If you have a kind of poetic mind frame, it's not enough to just scream. You know, that's too primal. But you can use whatever you have been endowed with, whether it's eloquence or some kind of intelligence or some artistic skill, and just keep the spirit moving along, keep the ball rolling.
Mm. Yeah. And the surrealists and Dada seem to just keep punching above their weight 100 years after it all happened. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Every generation rediscovers them and goes, holy shit, this is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. But that's because it's so powerful. And I mean, it was really needed as a kind of an antidote to a too mechanistic, too materialistic. And that's the very same reason why there was so much occultism going on at around the same time. It was like a counterforce. And I think I've argued many times that this is all part of what I call an acculturation. You know, there are so many things going from the occult into the mainstream, not necessarily thematically, but just like forgotten things, forgotten culture needs to be re-embraced to show that there are different ways of thinking and different ways of acting in times like these that seem absolutely destined for, you know, you can call it Judgment Day or Ragnarök or the Abyss or whatever the end times. It doesn't matter. It's not a good trajectory. And I think that acculturation is a result of the tectonic plates of the collective unconscious, like pressing forward life buoys in a way throwing us little life boys saying, hey, look at this weird artist, look at this weird magician, look at this weird religion, whatever it is, or art. And hopefully that will inspire people to say, whoa, this, what's going on is crazy. I feel empowered by this, you know, fairly strange person or art movement or whatever, but that can actually help people make decisions in a much wiser way.
Let's hope
so. That's been true historically also.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Carl, let's hear your fourth track. What track did you pick and why?
Yeah, I think we are absolutely not going chronologically here. We've been in the early and mid 80s, but at the time, mid 80s, when I had the Lollipop fanzine, what was going on then was very much this thing called garage rock. You know, it could be psychedelic or it could just be, you know, pretty fierce. But garage rock from the US, and also there was a big scene in Sweden, and we all loved the Cramps, the American band, the Cramps, and I still do. And it was kind of an antidote to when the industrial scene became too heavy or too lacking in humor, for instance. I loved to retort to or retire to, and I still do, I call it American trash. That's not, it's not derogatory, but this love of all the weird things about America that the Cramps also loved. And I think that they really nailed it on so many songs, specifically again from the two first albums but this one is from the second album called Psychedelic Jungle, and it's the Cramps with the song Primitive.
What I don't know that's working for me. What I respect, you just can't see. What you expect, I'll never be.
Primitive.
That's how I live.
Primitive.
I take what you give, 'cause I love and I live. What I get free, you have to buy. I'm proud of my life, but don't ask me why. 'Cause if I told you, I'd probably
put it in.
That's how I live.
Primitive.
I take what you give, 'cause I love and I live.
Primitive.
You give, 'cause I love.
by the Cramps off Psychedelic Jungle, one of the greatest rock and roll records of all time, in my view. I challenge anyone to argue against that position.
I'm not going to challenge you. Yeah, and I have a funny story there also, because of course we at the Lollipop thing, there was a date with Elvis tour in 1986, and we interviewed the Cramps. I went to the show in Stockholm and Malmö and some other places. In Stockholm, I was really front row. It was a seated theater, but people stood up close to the stage, and I took pictures. I got some good ones. And Lux was just carrying on, asking if anyone had a cigarette. And my friend, who's to the right of me, gave Lux a cigarette, and he sort of took it in his mouth and then sort of tilted his head up so that the cigarette flew in the air. It was like a real, you know, surreal spectacle. And I reached out my hand to grab the cigarette, maybe to give it back. And what he did was that Lux threw himself towards me and bit my finger, sort of missing the cigarette, but bit my finger and hung on to it. And the entire crowd was just like laughing at me. And in a way, I was kind of terrified of getting, I don't know, some kind of infectious disease.
Yeah.
But at the same time, incredibly honored that this cool guy was actually biting my finger. And of course, then, you know, he let go and the cigarette was lost and my finger got swollen. Was swollen for days, and I had a scar. It's unfortunately disappeared now, but it was a beautiful little white scar that lasted for years. One of my, I would say, proudest moments, but it was definitely a cool moment in which my love for the Cramps was, I guess, paid back in a way.
Yeah, they were so unbelievably rock and roll. The fact that, you know, in the last Esoteric Island Discs, we spoke with Gary Lachman, who is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I put it to him that the fact that the Cramps aren't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame almost makes me think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame needs to pack its bags and get out of here, because no one was carrying the flag of true rock and roll in the 1980s like the Cramps were. You know,
absolutely. It is absolutely a unique band. And I think that also came from that they were, and I mean this in a psychological sense, they were like stamp collectors. You know, they collected Americana, they collected records, they went on road trips to these weird places and collected, you know, vinyl records that they found of really obscure things, because they passionately loved it. It was like for real. It was never a career choice. And I remember that there were these criticisms going on when Lux became more and more of a cross-dresser in a way and performed in high heels and stuff like that. Some, you know, purist garage rocker said, you know, what's this? You know, this is weird. You know? But at the same time, not realizing that these are truly weird people. And whatever intuitive directions they're going in, it's as real as when they were in some dusty Texan small town finding the 7-inch of Primitive, for instance, that we just listened to.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of zest or attitude towards life, that it is a very passionate experience, or should be, I think that's true for many genuine artists. Not everyone. You can be a genuine artist and be completely reclusive or an asshole or be too intellectual, whatever. What really matters is, of course, what you put out, you know, what kind of material you put out, and if that has the power to touch people emotionally. And Cramps certainly did. Yeah, it was really remarkable because only this thing, it was so radical at the time to not have a bass player, right? You know, it's like you have, again, super primitive sound, but at the same time, they were connecting to the 60s, you know, having Alex Chilton produce the first album, Alex Chilton of the Box Tops, you know, such great music. And this was the kind of musical vibe that was going on in my life at this time, meaning basically mid to late 80s. There was the art stuff or the transgressive intellectual stuff with the industrial culture and becoming more interested in also electronic music. But there was this really, again, trashy, primitive rock and roll that I've always loved, because you can never deny what hits you emotionally. You just have to go with. And that, I think, brings us to the next song, which is both likely and unlikely. It's the Rolling Stones from Exile on Main Street, the song Let It Loose. And what I mean by the likely, unlikely thing is that British people have always adopted things from the Americans, but that's also been vice versa. American bands have always taken stuff from the British, etc.
Yeah.
But I think that what really changed things for me, I could say that I liked Rolling Stones, you know, with Brian Jones and the early stuff from the 60s, but it's not like really hardcore in that sense. But when they actually moved over to the US in the early 70s and went on these crazy debauch tours, I really worked with American musicians also, and I guess became a little bit too metabolically challenged. That's when it was really cool. You know, and Exile on Main Street is a really good album, and this song is my favorite, Let It Loose, from Exile on Main Street.
Move that woman on, all dressed up to do your harm, and I'm here to watch you do. Give her just about a month or two,
just about a month or two.
Get off!
Let It Loose by the Rolling Stones, Exile on Main Street. The Stones, they're an interesting band. They really, really are interesting. They're so huge. They're such megastars that the sort of avant-gardist in me doesn't want to admit that I like them because they're just totally mainstream. But they actually did some really, really interesting, weird, experimental stuff. And in this track, they're just going for this kind of quite odd Baptist church choir meets blues meets whatever guitar amp happened to be in the studio that day sound.
I agree. And also, it's like something you can, as an artist, you can try to do that, but it's unlikely that you'll get away with it. But I think they do on this album specifically, because it's so immersed in real people, in real stuff, in the real spirit of the land in a way. And I think that's really cool, because one thing I admire about them, I don't like all of their phases or albums or anything, but they have always sort of developed. And I think initially it was driven by Brian Jones. He was very much of an innovator, but it certainly didn't stop with him dying and disappearing. I think they've done a lot of great stuff after that. And I mean, technically they're still rocking, right? Even if they're like 85 now or something. That's the power of money right there. I think that for me, this track specifically sort of ties in with the earlier stuff that we've listened to. As you can hear, it's very much always in a minor key. It's about melancholy. It's about depression. It's not happy-go-lucky, jolly stuff. And I think that really summed up my mind frame at the time. I wouldn't say so much anymore, but there was this need in me to vent things and become using music as a catharsis in a way. And that really opened up my mind as a musician also, in the sense that if you ride the waves of these emotions, you can see them clearer for what they are. And that can hopefully lead to some kind of resolution, like resolve things that are negative. And that really worked for me. And I can still, with certain bands, we'll return to one of those. I mean, a contemporary band still has that power to sway me like a wave in a way and get me into that daydreaming mind frame. And we'll save that song for a little bit. As you know, I've tried my hand at different things in terms of output. Like, I've been doing a lot of writing, more and more so. I've tried my hand at filmmaking, making music, photography, stuff like that. And I can retrospectively say that I'm not really happy with everything, but I don't know if anyone is. But I think that for me, the music specifically was, I mean, the musical expressions that I tried to create, to either alone or with other people, was very much a matter of influence. Like, we wanted to make something like this, like them.
Right.
And then I think that's cool when you're young, but later on, I found that it doesn't hold up. You know, you have to find your own voice, just like when you're writing or whatever artistic expression, you have to find your own voice. And I think the writing is absolutely closest to me where I've done that. And now, unfortunately, my main musical partner died from COVID in 2020. And since then, I've sort of lost the urge or the impetus in a way to make new music. I've tried, but you know, there I definitely need some kind of a partner or third mind thing. So that feels a little bit left. And movies is very difficult in the sense that it's usually a very collaborative effort, and I like more and more to be on my own. So I think writing will be the future of us. And then I can sort of look back and see not necessarily where things went wrong or what I'm displeased with. I'm very proud of many things. Like, for instance, I made 3 albums with Genesis, spoken word albums, that are really very, very good. But it's not only because of me. I was part of a collaborative effort there that turned out really, really well. But I think that it's one of the things I talked about, the magical toolbox before. And you can go through different phases, different sort of inspirations in terms of systems or key people, whatever it is. But you can never escape the fact that the main tool that you have is, of course, yourself. And that individuation is always the most important tool that you have, because it doesn't end. you may think that you've come to a point of finalized individuation. This is me, you know, this is my voice. This, but it never ends. You know, you change all the time. So I think that one of the key tools in that toolbox is also honesty. You know, you have to be honest with yourself. And that's why when I talk to people about their magical processes, I usually ask them about their guilty pleasures, because there's no better test when it comes to personal honesty than to have someone admit to what their guilty pleasures are. You know, sometimes people are reticent. They are not willing to disclose what their guilty pleasures are, because it would be so contrarian in a way to the image that they want to present or the projections that they have on them. That is something that I think about a lot, about being constantly as honest as I can about what I like and don't like. And that, the reason I mention this is that some things that I used to like, I simply don't like anymore. That goes for culture, you know, some movie makers. I used to love Ken Russell, but today I can't watch Ken Russell. I just don't like it. And that goes for some music too, and some authors that were really important, but now I just can't read it. So you just have to really, it's a cliche, you know, but you have to go with the flow and be honest about all these shifts. And that's why it was interesting to make this little playlist, because I thought, oh my God, there's so much old stuff here, you know. But I tried to think of, you know, favorite songs. I listen to music differently now than I used to, right? Back then, it was my favorite, this is in quotes, bands or constellations or people that I listened to repetitively over and over and over again, probably to dissolve emotional inner tantrums, whatever, because there was an emotional resonance there. But I don't have those bands today, except for one. And maybe it's time to play a song from that band. It's an American band, all-female band called Warpaint, and they've made some amazing albums. And the reason I like them, I think, is I don't have to give a reason, but I think that they are a younger generation, and they've backtracked and listened to all the bands that I used to like. And they made their own composite in a most delightful way. And this song is from the first album. It's called Undertow by Warpaint.
Better not to quit.
Undertow by Warpaint. Yeah, this does stand out as not from the 70s and 80s at the latest, sort of.
And I can't really explain that. You know, why are you hypnotically drawn into, for instance, one musician or one band's output? What is the magic, you know? And I think that's the time when you shouldn't be what Crowley called a scientific something, you know, that kind of empirical approach to
scientific
to magic.
Illuminist, I think.
Exactly. I'm not opposed to it, but I think that magic is magic and it should just be an amorphous emotional thing, should not be dissected or analyzed. And that's right. Why, you know, I can talk about these things. The reason why I love these bands or these musicians is that they can weave that spell that draws me in, and in which I can have these amazing fantasies, usually tied in with the emotional vibe of the song, and then process my own stuff. So basically, you know, it's like attracts like, in a way. Warpaint's amazing band. They've been going for a while, and everything they've done is just like, wow, can draw me right in there. And that's quite a feat. And I'm sure they haven't planned that. It's just their connection in between themselves as musicians and, you know, the way they write songs, etc., for some reason really affects me as a person here in Sweden. It's weird, but I just love it. And that's whether now, for instance, I listen to, you know, Bach or Mozart or Wagner, basically Bruckner, you know, classical composers, they can drag me in into that kind of reverie. But it's never the same thing because there are no words there. And if right. there are words, they're usually in German about Jesus, and who cares?
Yeah.
But these bands are creating a poetry that is close enough for me to be attentive, but not too much, too clearly, so that I have to listen to what they sing about. It's vague enough. That's the beauty of poetry, in a way.
Yeah.
It sounds so beautiful, you don't know why. And I think that's the reason why most of the greatest poetry is actually quite banal. But when you scratch the surface, you find stuff there that
right.
maybe was intended or maybe it wasn't. That's an interaction between the sender and the receiver in a yeah. kind of semiotic way. That said, you know, there are these bedrock works of art that have never left me. The films of Polanski, for instance, the literature of Ernst Jünger and Hermann Hesse, and I would have to say the music of the Stooges. Same Iggy is like the Rolling Stones in a way, perhaps a little bit more integrity. I haven't liked everything that Iggy has done, but the Stooges is one of those bedrock things. You cannot question it. You know, it's so yeah. massively cemented as the most crystallized work of art that you can never really argue with. And that in itself is very magical because, again, it can evoke and drag you in, like I said, for this reverential reverie where you can process your own emotions, or you can just like be in awe about how these sort of weird, strung out, aggressive, weird young people in late 60s America could create such, I don't know, masterpieces of supreme beauty in their stripped, raw feeling. You know, but that's how I feel about Stooges and again the Stooges, and specifically about the second album, Funhouse. And I think that's a perfect album. Each track could fit here. If I could, I would bring the entire album to the Deserted
right. I'm
Island.
I'm afraid you're not allowed to do that, so you're gonna have to pick one track.
I know, and I'm not even gonna try. So I'm very happy to pick out and bring the song Dirt.
say, do you feel it when you touch me? Say, do you feel it when you touch me? There's a fire. There's a fire. Yeah, right. Oh!
Dirt by the Stooges off Funhouse. The bass sound, the bass tone on that song, just...
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you can see there also in terms of transference, like, you know, do you think that Joy Division listened to Stooges? Of course they did. Do you think that Martin Hannett, the producer, had listened to Stooges and Funhouse and all these things? Of course he had. So there are these very clear trails of influence, and those trails are... carrying what I call the spirit, and we don't have to define what the spirit is, but it's just a, let's call it, spirit of defiance, a spirit of absolute integrity, is a spirit of going against hypocrisy, basically a spirit of youth, right? And we can try to contain it, we can try to hone it, own it, and work with it in our own artistic processes, but it is the same. And we mentioned briefly before I think Ficino and other early people, philosophers, magicians, artists who've gone against the grain. It's the same spirit, and we're working with it today, but as best we can, maybe even in this conversation, to make people aware of that the prefab culture is not necessarily the best culture, and that there's always more when you scratch the surface and when you dig deeper and you can unearth things. And that's basically what I call the acculturation process that's going on right now. I don't think we've ever seen as much acculturation going on. And I think that is a very, very good thing, even though it's cheesy, even though it's like, you know, pentagram t-shirts at H&M, it doesn't matter. I think people need to be exposed to something that is different and goes against the grain of the death drive driven culture that we're in.
I hear you. My fear, though, is, or just to push back a bit or to interject a note of brooding dissonance, that this acculturation project or process that's happening as Western culture turns to steam through digital media and so on and so forth, there's a co-optation going on. It's not just the pentagram t-shirt at H&M. It's the tech billionaires. You know what I mean? They're aware of magic. They're aware of psychedelics. They're aware of this stuff. And they, it seems to me, are much more on the death drive side.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So co-optation is always a possibility and a danger that you need to watch out for.
Absolutely. Or I think it might be an unavoidable part of the game in
maybe
a way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, see it as, you know, waves crashing and then becoming again like an undertow or a pendulum swinging back and forth. And this co-opting thing, is always think of punk, you know. It was this thing where the music industry came in. Oh, wow, this is cool. You know, we can make money from this. There's always that thing, whether it's actual culture being produced or the ideas behind them. They will always be commodified and brought into the mainstream. And, of course, that may be diluting them. Very likely it will be. But I think it doesn't affect the spirit in itself. The spirit will just find another way of creating some other flowers of evil in a way. In another soil. So I think, again, that's maybe what I have liked about and how I see, for instance, the symbol of Satan as presented by, you know, LaVey and the Church of Satan, is this force that goes against to pinpoint and sort of touch the raw nerve ends, the exposed nerve ends of hypocrisy, so that the main organism can be healthy again and be devoid of this particular corruption or whatever it is. But then again, you know, all living organisms fight for survival. Even the ones who are death drive driven, strangely, paradoxically enough.
Yeah. All right, Carl, you are about to be cast away on the esoteric island.
Thank you.
You're going to be kind of taken outside the drama perforce. You're going to be all alone with your seven tracks. How do you think you're going to do?
I think I'm going to do well until I won't. I like being alone very much. Is it in a tropical setting?
Yeah, sure.
Ooh, okay, well, I can find some shadow and hope that I have some sweet water, and then I'll probably listen to these tracks and mope, be melancholy, and then we'll see what happens, and then maybe I'll do some magic and someone will save me.
Okay, well, I'm afraid there is no escape. It's like the village in The Prisoner. There's no way out of the esoteric island.
But that's very interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, I accept that. I accept my fate then.
But on this island, I'm going to give you also the Corpus Hermeticum and the complete works of John Dee in translation of your choice to keep you company. You may also take a book of your own choice. What book would you like to have?
Oh, my God. Yeah, that might be the hardest question. I think I would bring a book of magic for me, and it's not a book of magic technically. It's a book that always provides me with new insights and a new reading experience each time I read it, and I've never figured out why that is or how that can be. It's a short novel by Ernst Jünger called On the Marble Cliffs. And it's definitely one of my favorites. So I'd probably bring that, not to analyze it, but because I enjoy reading it after like the umpteenth time, I can still enjoy reading it and thereby be amazed again at how a work of art, even in translation actually, can elevate your mind simply through existence, you know.
Okay, so On the Marble Cliffs by Ernst Jünger in Swedish translation?
Yeah, English or Swedish. I think I might actually take the Swedish, but because I believe that that translation is closer to the German. I've read it in German as well, but I'm not so fluent that I can read like undisturbed in a way.
Yeah,
there's some words I need to figure out and stuff.
Yeah.
So I would probably take the Swedish one, yeah.
Okay, in addition to that volume, you are allowed one luxury item.
Oh, okay. Well, I know exactly what that would be. That would be an exquisite fountain pen that I have.
Okay.
And it doesn't need to be functional because there's nowhere on the island where I can buy more ink and stuff. So I would bring it as an object.
Well, because this is the esoteric island, you can actually have a magical fountain pen with an unlimited supply of ever-flowing ink.
That sounds good.
So if you could just get yourself some...
Here's the problem with civilization, because then I would also need a notebook or paper.
Well,
see, it never ends.
I hear you, but I think like if you get some coconut shells and you could maybe make them into some kind of writing material or crab, you know, shells or something like that. You'll find a way to write. You'll find a way to write
even
with your
better,
magic fountain pen.
I could sharpen the nib of the fountain pen and tattoo myself and make myself like Ray Bradbury's The Illustrated Man.
That's a great idea.
And then when they find me, eventually I will have written a book on myself,
and hopefully you will have sort of mummified in the hot sun of the esoteric
hopefully
island.
Yeah,
so there's this sort of novel, the final, yeah, the posthumous novel,
eaten by crabs.
Yeah. All right, Carl Abrahamsson, my final question for you is, if you could choose just one disc to save from the waves of the seven tracks you've given us, what would that be?
You mean like pick out one?
You have to, if you have to pick the only one you can bring. If for some disaster there's a giant wave and it takes away six of your tracks, which one would you want to survive?
I would go for the first one, New Order, Dreams Never End, because not only because I love it so much and it's great, but it also carries some kind of slight positive note, right? You know, dreams never end, you know, and if life is but a dream, etc., etc. I think that's a good message. Dreams never end, so I would pick that song.
All right, I'm about to cast you away. Thank you, Carl Abrahamsson, for sharing with us your esoteric island discs.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. Goodbye. I will now never see anyone again.
Yep.